because it's so long and such a big thing to plan. And I was kind of like, well, you know, if I keep on saying two more years, it's never going to happen. So I think I just have to do it this year.
I was kind of hesitant to commit to myself.
For so many people, including my husband, Jake, the divide is often considered a bucket list or someday ride. Someday when there's more time, more money, more fitness, when it can neatly fit into your life. But the reality is, how could a ride of this magnitude ever fit neatly into a box of time? After some changes this past winter, Jake decided someday was this year. With 4 months to prepare, he committed to himself that he would line up in Banff at this year's Tour Divide, ready to give it everything he had. After 16 days, 9 hours, and 41 minutes, Jake reached Antelope Wells, good enough to take 19th overall. In this episode, we talk all about Jake's ride down the divide, about finding your own rhythm in ultra racing, learning to trust your instincts, what happens when you finally say yes to a ride you've dreamed about for years, and his advice to anyone dreaming of taking on their own big ride, or even the Tour Divide. My name is Mel Webb, and this is Detours, a show about bikepacking, ultra endurance, and the many different ways people find freedom on two wheels. We share the highs, the lows, and of course, the detours along the way. This show is made possible by Albion Cycling, clothing and accessories designed to help you stay outside for longer. And now you can use our new discount code DETOURS15 to get 15% off your order. Fun fact, Jake's Zoa rain jacket has made it through every single ultra he's done. Silk Road twice, a whole bunch in North America, and now the Divide, and it's kept him dry and cozy. You can check out Albion's products through the link in our show notes or head to albioncycling.com. Alrighty, on to the show.
We need to do a sponsor read for Strathcona Brewing at the start of this one.
Jake insisted on cracking beers before recording this because I can see him across the room. He's already looking so nervous.
So nervous. But no, they're not. They're Radlers. I didn't want to get too crazy on this. I just, you know, a little something to loosen me up a little bit.
I spill it on myself. We're not really good at being normal people when trying to, for context for listeners, we tried to record a Silk Road podcast about our race last year, I think 3 times.
Yeah. I mean, at least 3 times in one day, plus maybe like another day or two attempting as well. And I don't know, it just never flowed.
Okay. Well, this has to flow because
that's why I suggested the beaches, because we want it to flow.
So Jake did a really big ass bike ride. I've talked about it a little bit on the pod. We're bringing Jake out of his shell. And it's, when did we get home from?
It's been just about 3 weeks now, or has it been 3 weeks? It's been 3 weeks. We would have got home 3 weeks ago yesterday.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Like, time has flown, but also at the same time, I think I was just in a fog for the first 2 weeks and like finally starting to feel human again. So I don't know.
You,
maybe it makes sense.
In a fog, falling asleep on the couch every night, eating, oh my God, the amount of ice cream, like Häagen-Dazs, Ben and Jerry's.
PC your brand, the cheapest stuff.
Ice cream sponsor, get your asses over here. Jake needed you these last 2 weeks.
Yeah, I really did. I mean, and you only saw the ice cream here. I've also had like a nonstop supply of ice cream at work as well, just to like make sure I've stayed topped up. So
my eyes just bugged out of my head when he said that, but I digress. I've heard so much about the Tour Divide, but I feel like I'll probably still learn a lot asking you all these questions that people would benefit from, because these things kind of come back in waves. Like, We'll just be cooking dinner and you'll be like, oh, I didn't tell you about this thing that happened on the divide.
I think like, cause it's so long, like 16 days is such a long time and you experience so much. It's really hard to like remember to say everything and tell every story. And like, I mean, yeah, I don't even remember most of the stuff that happened. And then like little things will like trigger that memory and make me be like, oh my God, like I totally forgot that this happened. Or like, I met this person. So yeah, I think maybe we'll trigger some memories that I forgot about. Who knows?
I hope. Okay. before we go back to the beginning about prepping for the divide, getting to the start, how 3 weeks since finishing, we'll get to how broken you were when you got to Antelope Wells, but how is the body doing? There's been some physio. What's rehab been like?
Rehab has been, I think, slower than normal for coming back from an ultra. Like, I feel like I normally bounce back relatively quickly. Definitely more fatigue this time than I'm used to. And then, yeah, like the body in general, like my legs felt good right away. But what's really been tough for me is rehabbing my upper body back from it, particularly my nerves, my ulnar nerve. Like, as most people who have done an ultra know, you do pinch your ulnar nerve, and that's what causes you to start to lose feeling in kind of your pinky, your ring finger, and part of your middle finger. And so I had a very pinched ulnar nerve, and I've just got feeling back in my ring finger, which is exciting. So just the pinky on both hands to go. But yeah, I've been doing physio to try to floss that nerve to basically
unkink it. Nerve flossing. Maybe this is not such a crazy phenomena, but when you came home from physio the first time and you're like, I have to floss my nerves, it's much more straightforward than I'm making it sound, but it blew my mind.
Yeah, I mean, the first time I had to nerve floss was actually when I got hit by a car last year and had some hip problems and had to do nerve flossing through my leg. And that was like a total game changer for my rehab. I'd been dealing with like some really persistent tingling feeling in my feet, and that like all but eliminated it. And so when I went to physio and he was like, okay, we're going to teach you how to floss your ulnar nerve, I was like, oh, this is going to be awesome, because I was already so excited. But basically what you're doing is you're finding like the two points where your nerve is linked, like at either end, and you're pulling one and kind of letting the other go. And so you're basically pulling your nerve through, I guess, like the sheath of the nerve, like a piece of floss. And so it's just moving it very slightly back and forth in your body.
And what's the purpose?
The purpose is to loosen the nerve up. Like if something is pinching it, like a tight muscle. And so moving it back and forth kind of helps to loosen it, basically.
Woohoo. Go Charlie Shin at the physio across the street. Thank God we live across the street from
physio. So convenient. Great for physio, great for RMT. I wish I had more insurance coverage for both of them so I could go more often. But yeah, no, the physio is definitely helping a lot, starting to get feeling back. Although he did, when I mentioned I was doing Colorado Trail, which is maybe a spoiler alert, his face did kind of go a little like, oh no, like you're not doing another one of these things. But I assured him it was much shorter and I should do much less damage this time.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. The heart wants what the heart wants, and Jake's heart and legs and mind and all the things clearly want to go to Colorado after riding 4,400 and whatever kilometers. So, I mean, hell yeah, power to...
Just didn't get enough of Colorado the first time. I feel like I was in a funk all through Colorado, so I want to go back with a fresh mind, fresh perspective.
I was going to say, when you're like, I didn't get enough of Colorado, and then you quickly were like, I was in a funk, I was going to interject and say, yeah, you were in a bad mood for like all of Colorado, saying how much you didn't think it was as awesome as everybody said it was.
Yeah, and like in hindsight, it was super awesome. Like thinking back to it, there's so many cool things and really cool passes. And unfortunately, I think a lot of the cool passes I did at night, which kind of sucks. Like I kept on ending up in like towns right at dinner time. And so it wasn't good to stop there. So I'd like eat and then like push on and take on a pass that like I could tell was beautiful in the dark, which kind of is a bummer. But yeah, no, I think Colorado was really beautiful in hindsight and a really cool place. And the riding was actually quite nice. I was just not in the right mind frame to truly absorb it and appreciate it.
I know. I'm trying to like allow you to tell your story versus my perspective of how the ride went down, because obviously, you know, I was only getting a fraction, but this is your story. So I guess let's start at the beginning. Tour Divide this year came onto the radar in February.
Yeah, you were in Atlas and you'd kind of like let me know that like you didn't think Silk Road as a pair was going to work out this year because you were going to have to be producing the Mountain Race podcast there, which is super sick. So I was like so happy for you. But then also my mind instantly pivoted to like, okay, like I've done Silk Road once solo already. Like, let's pull up the calendar and see what other races there are. And originally I was looking for something else in August. Nothing really called to me. And then I was like, okay, like I was going to do Hellenic in May. I was like, okay, maybe I could pull something off in July. And I kept on looking through the calendar and I saw Divide in June. And I was like, well, I couldn't do Hellenic in that. And I was like, well, maybe I don't have to do Hellenic. Like I've wanted to do Divide for, I don't know how long. Since I've known about the race pretty much, it's been something I've been super interested in. And I've always been like, it's a 1 year race. Like I'm going to do that like 2 years from now. Yeah, someday. And it's always been like 2 years out from whatever year it is. And the next year it'd be like, yeah, 2 more years. Because it's so long and such a big thing to plan. And I was kind of like, well, you know, if I keep on saying 2 more years, it's never going to happen. So I think I just have to do it this year. And so 4 months out, I was like, yeah, I'm doing Divide. Wrote my letter of intent and was just like, let's go.
It was the coolest pivot. Because I am always harping on Jake to be more of an action man. He's very deliberate and we're both thoughtful in our planning, but you're certainly more patient and maybe take a little bit more time. And yeah, when you're like, I'm going to do the Divide, what do you think? I mean, you didn't really ask permission. You just said, I'm going to do it. And I was just like, you've got action. Let's fucking go.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't sure what you were going to think of me being like, yeah, I'm going to do the Divide this year. But yeah, no, I was so happy that you were just like, instantly on board, like, hell yeah, go for it.
I mean, how could I not be? It's so fucking cool. Four months out is still a sufficient amount of time to get in a relatively good training block. Some people dedicate years of their lives to doing this big ride. Obviously, you should share more about like your background a little bit to understand the base level of fitness that you're coming in with, but then also, like for people listening, what did that 4 months look like? Because that's quite a big amount of time, but also a really short amount of time to figure out how to even get the legs, the gear, all the things ready for race day.
Yeah, I mean, like in terms of going way back to base level of fitness, I used to race on the road at a reasonably high level for North America.
Alex Howes peed on him.
Yeah.
At a race.
Cascade Classic 2017. Yeah. So I had that kind of fitness way back when. Definitely since the pandemic, I've lost quite a bit of fitness because I stopped doing specific training in 2020. Basically, when the pandemic hit, I was going to race through 2020. It hit. I stopped doing intervals and I've never really looked back. I didn't love the training part. I loved racing. I loved riding my bike, but I didn't love training. And then I'd kind of fall into bike packing.
What didn't you love? You've actually never articulated that to me. I'm sorry for interrupting you, but what didn't you love about training?
I just don't love the repetitiveness of training. Like when I used to be coached and I'd get my weekly plan, my favorite days were always like 5 hours zone two or like.
Is five hours of zone two not extremely repetitive?
No, because I could just go ride the Sea to Sky Highway, which is like a beautiful coastal stretch of road here that's like rolling hills, mountains in the background, ocean. Like it's a phenomenal ride. It's on a busy highway, but there's a wide shoulder. A lot of people hate it. I love it. And so I'd always love like doing big, just steady state days or big days with some efforts mixed in. But I was never a fan of like a 3 hour session where I would go and do like 10 minute efforts or over unders. Stuff like that. I mean, I didn't mind the hurting part of intervals. I just didn't like the repetitiveness and I didn't like having my week so planned out, I guess, like knowing.
See, that part checks out to me.
Yeah. I like being able to like be a bit drifty with my riding of like, I don't even know where I'm going to go today. I'm just going to head out the door and see where it takes me. And that's like the 5 hour ride was great for that. Cause it's like, oh, I could do like 5 hours and stay relatively close to home, or I could do 5 hours and just go like one way long out and one way back. And yeah, so didn't love that part of training, but I fell in love with bikepacking. And then that kind of led to in 2019, I signed up for the 2020 Silk Road Mountain Race. I was going to race road and then do Silk Road. And then the pandemic happened and I had deferred until 2022 because 2021 traveling from North America was still a bit sketchy, I'd say. And then, yeah, did Silk Road as my first ultra, slept like 8 hours a night, loved it, but like rode hard during the day. And then have got more into like, I guess, the racing part of it and trying to go fast. And I think that's like inevitably led me to wanting to like perform and maybe thinking more about how I prepare for races.
Okay, cool. Great background. I learned something. I love learning things. Okay. So I know you didn't really train for this race. Like you didn't do any intervals, but what did you do in terms of preparation over those 4 months?
Yeah. I mean, even leading in before the 4 months, I'd like been training, again, not doing intervals, but like riding my bike.
Actually, I do need to tell people you did a couple intervals on the trainer with me.
Oh, yes. Okay. And the one
actually,
exception.
You did some when I was doing the VO2 max block before Atlas. You did some intervals.
I even was doing intervals on the trainer while you were away too, doing Atlas.
So you lied. You did train a bit.
I did train a bit, but it was never like I didn't have a weekly plan. It was kind of like I got on the trainer and like looked at my old workouts that I'd built when I was racing and been like, yeah, let's do this one. But yeah, I was like training for Hellenic. And so I was doing more volume than I've done in the past 5 years, inside and outside. I was doing intervals on the trainer, not really like planned or really focused intervals, but I was like doing efforts and working hard. And so I was like training towards this goal of doing Hellenic. I figured short race, so like more intensity. And then pivoting to Divide, in those 4 months, I wouldn't say I really changed my training a ton. I think I just tried to really stay consistent with it and keep riding, keep doing efforts on rainy days inside, otherwise trying to do some bigger days outside. But looking back, I don't think I really did any ride over 150K this year before Divide. I'd have to check back on my Strava for that one, but I feel like the longest ride I did was probably like 6 hours,
120K. That's not very long.
Yeah, I mean, 6 hours for some people is long, but definitely like preparing for Divide, I don't think it's necessarily enough volume.
I mean, I'm thinking about
volume.
The Divide days where you like... Well, I'm not going to say how big some of your days were because they were just nuts.
Yeah, I mean, my longest day was 25 hours. So to go from like 6 hour rides to like doing that, and that was deep into the race at that point. So yeah, I guess I'd maybe trained into that or ridden into the fitness to do that, or the, I don't even want to call it fitness, but numbness to big days to just say, yeah, sure, 25 hours.
I mean, you were fit because you went on some group rides and they... I recall you reporting back to me and saying you dropped some people.
Yeah, I was doing some of the like the fast group rides with the racers in the city, and I wasn't at the very like tippy top, but I was in like the top three where it counted. And to kind of be back in that place of like keeping up with Cat 1-2 racers without having to do a lot of training. I mean, at one point I was like, oh, maybe I should start like road racing and kart racing again.
The pipeline when you get a little bit of fitness to being like, oh, maybe I should do that again is so quick.
Yeah, it's very fast. I'm like, oh yeah, like if I like did racing, that would also help me get ready for like ultras if I was like doing like a bunch of 150K road races. And then people I know show up at work the next day covered in Tegaderm. I'm like, nah, I don't need to race ever again. I don't need to be bandaging myself up.
And he spilled his beer. He's too comfortable, which is so great.
Too warm, so it's to cool me off.
Yeah. Well, it got hot on the Divide. So fitness-wise, we covered that. Gear, this was, I would say, a pretty different setup from anything, aside from the bike, anything you've ever run on an ultra. Walk us through how you went about getting all the gear ready.
Yeah, I mean... different, but also very similar in terms of like the contents of what I packed. I'd say I've kept it pretty consistent. Like it was my same helium bivy that I used at Silk Road 3 years ago. I've like got a lighter pad and a lighter sleeping bag since then, but a lot of the stuff has stayed the same. My bike I've used for a couple years now, since 2023. The biggest difference was Mel was so kind to lend me like her full tail fin setup, which was unreal. I tested a bit in the early spring on some bike packs we did and was sold kind of right away on it. And I was able to shift how I pack a lot. But I think like in terms of the contents and what I brought, it was stuff that I was like very confident in all the gear. I'd used most of it at Silk Road either 2 years ago or last year or on BC Epic or Hellenic Mountain Race. So I knew what I was bringing was the right stuff. It was just how I packed it. And that was kind of a big eye opener for me for how nicely I could kind of pack things with the tail fin setup.
Where did you move things around?
I basically flipped everything front to back. So I normally, or I shouldn't say normally, I used to run my sleep setup in my front roll because I could had a really big front roll and could kind of just slide it all in. And then with the tail fin setup, I decided to put my full sleep setup in the back and then all of my clothes in the front. And so with the sleep setup in the back, when I set up tent or set up camp, just pull it straight out, roll my bivy out, and get right in. And then if I stayed in a motel and needed clothes, I just took my front bag off and had all my clothes right there. So super easy.
And the Beamer, the BMC, is so long. So the 3-liter top tube bag, it's honestly not long enough. I think you probably could get...
I could squeeze another 500 mil of space on there easily.
Tailfin, if you're listening, we need a 3.5 liter.
Yeah, 3.5 liter top tube bag or a micro rear top tube bag to fit in the tiny gap at the back of it.
And you wore a backpack, which I guess maybe to jump super far ahead, but do you feel going into Colorado, will you run your backpack as heavy as you did during Divide, given how it made your body feel? Well, explain how it made your body feel and then.
Yeah. So, I mean, on day 5 of the Divide, I want to say, I started to get neck pain kind of like through my shoulders and delts, and then kind of like down the center of my back, in between my two shoulder blades. And I started to get kind of worried that it was like early signs of Shermer's neck. The day that it really started to, I started to notice it was like a day after I did a really big, like aero bar intensive day, like lots of like road flat riding. And so, I think it was kind of two factors. Was like, one, I had a lot of stuff in my backpack because there was a long stretch with no resupply. And so I was carrying most of my food on my body rather than on my bike. And then two, my aero bars were potentially too low. Mel will tell you that
Mel
they
will
were
tell
definitely
you they
low.
Were definitely too low. He's like, oh, I'm just going to borrow this tiny riser of yours. And I was like, I think you should take the really tall setup. It might look crazy right now. I promise you, it's going to be so comfy. And he's like, no, I like my bikes aggressive because I came off the road. And anyways, I don't need to say I told you so, but...
Before I do my next race, it's going to require aero bars. Fortunately, Colorado is going to be aero barless, but next time we use aero bars, I'm going to test out using a higher stack height before the race and see if I like it.
I guess the lesson there from Divide, like, or maybe the question for you... Regardless of how low your aero bars were, do you feel like in training and preparation, you spent enough time in them, did enough long rides, like with the backpack loaded in the aero bars to just gauge whether or not, like, obviously you can't replicate the feeling of riding 18, 19 hours in a day in your training frequently. Like, that's just not possible. But I guess I would want to know, and maybe for other people who are considering doing it, like, did you feel you did enough time to get comfortable with the setup?
Going into the race, I definitely would have said, yes, I did enough time. But like now coming out the other side, I think I probably could have done more days in the aero bars with a loaded bag. Like we did, I was riding with my loaded backpack pretty much every weekend ride. I would like find a reason to bring it. Like there was times where I was like selling shoes on Marketplace and delivering them to the burbs. And I was like riding that bike out with aero bars and like the shoes in my backpack to like sell shoes out of it. And it was like great to just like have it loaded. But I think I probably could have done more long rides on that setup. I did a lot of like, I'd say medium length rides, but like nothing super long. And yeah, maybe not as much like back to back to back stuff. Like it was lots of like Saturday, Sunday, but I think I needed to maybe throw an extra day in there just to like really get used to it.
Good tip. Yeah, I was just curious. It's always like when you're going into a race, you always want to tell yourself that you've done the right preparation so you don't really ever like, at least I don't like to think about those things, but you know, just a lesson for next time. And also like you can't replicate a ride that big, but there's probably things you can do to like prepare the body a little bit more.
Definitely, yeah. And I mean, like one of the things, and you like kind of tell me this all the time, is I need to do more strength training. And I probably do need to do more strength training to like keep my upper body functioning well. Cause like, who knows, maybe like I did ride enough with that setup. I just didn't do enough.
We can have a whole pod on why the upper body strength is the thing we all need to be doing. Someone out there is going to listen to this and inevitably come for me and say, you don't need to. But my physio, anyways, I digress. Whole different can of worms. Preparation was awesome. We could probably record like this entire conversation about preparation, but I think gear, you have a great video on that. People should go check that out. I'll put it in the show notes.
You can see everything I brought with me. And I can tell you, I think I used pretty much everything except for like two things in that video that I say I didn't use this.
Love it. We went out to Banff. Oh God, it was a lifetime ago. It was Friday the 13th was all I remember. And the G7 was in Banff. What were your... I mean, you had a little bit of luxury. I got to take your bag home for you and stuff. And so you didn't have to just be like ditching your things. But what was the feelings like getting on the plane when everything was packed away and you're like, this is happening?
I would say I was semi-nervous until I was building the bike in our hotel parking lot on Saturday morning, which was like the day before the race.
You mean Thursday morning?
Thursday morning, yeah. Because it started on Friday, didn't it? It did. Yeah, no. So I feel like every time that I've done a race, I've shown up a few days beforehand. It's normally been like we go to Europe or to Central Asia and we go a full week beforehand. We build our bikes, we ride our bikes quite a bit and we know everything is working. Or the opposite of that is it's so local that we drive there and our bikes don't get disassembled. And so this was like a bit weird to fly and show up like the day before the event and be like, okay, hopefully I remembered everything, A, because that's always my biggest stress, and then B, the airline didn't break my stuff. And so I definitely had some nerves around everything being good. But then as soon as my bike was built, I went out for my little shakeout and then we met up with Quinda for lunch. I just felt so relaxed after that. I was just like, ah, I just have to eat and chill now. That's all I got to do. And it was like, I don't know. It was just very like refreshing and fun. And I felt that the stress and like pressure of the event just kind of like disappeared until the next morning.
Yeah. You mentioned pressure. Let's talk about expectations going in. What were your goals and what were you hoping to get out of the ride?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of goals, like time-wise, I was really wanting to be in the 16 to 18 day range. I feel like it's such a long race. I struggled to figure out where I would end up. And like, I've only ever tried to go quite fast at shorter races, like 3 days or less. And so to be like, okay, this is going to be like 2+ weeks. Like, I don't know how long this is going to take me. And so I gave myself a pretty big range of like expected finishing time. And then in the back of my mind, I also had like 15 days would be super cool. But that was kind of like my stretch goal if I was like really riding fast and everything went right. And I think 15 days, like looking back, it could have been doable, but also like I'm super happy to have come in within my goal time range.
Yeah. I mean, you're trending towards 15 days and change for, I think, all the way into Colorado until you hit the death mud on Indiana. Like, it was still within reach as you were like kind of flirting with the border of New Mexico.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely like, I feel like it started to slip away a little bit before the death mud. Like if my days got shorter distance wise, but stayed long in terms of time. And then, yeah, the death mud, I think like, I don't want to say it was the nail in the coffin, but that really like, it was 2 hours to cover like a kilometer or a few kilometers. And then I just like fell asleep. And then when I woke up the next morning, I realized I was like a few hundred meters from the end of the mud. And I was like, oh, if I'd pushed on last night, I could have got here. But it was also like 12:30 a.m. So like what difference would have making that extra few hundred meters made?
Yeah. I mean, what difference would it have made when you're tired and you don't want to do it anymore? But I mean, each state could be its own whole long saga.
Yeah.
Why don't we do like a couple minutes on each one? Before we do that, though, it's a huge race. I've said that a couple times, but like going into that, obviously having goals, time goals, and then thinking about how you break down that distance. Like, what was the strategy there? I know you had a cue sheet. Let's walk through that just a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of like where I thought I would be each day and like distance goals and stuff, outside of the first day, I didn't really know. And especially like after the first half, I like really, really didn't know. So, I mean, day one, my goal was to get to Fernie, which I knew was super achievable. I knew I'd probably be there early. And my plan was to get a motel on night one, sleep inside, have a really like good proper rest to like kind of kick things off on the right note and not get too pulled into racing and pulled into like cut sleep, like go fast. And so after Fernie, I kind of had no idea where I would be each day. I just kind of knew how far or how long I would ride. And however far I went was kind of as far as I went.
Did you give yourself time limits on like stop time during the day or like number of stops?
No limits on number of stops, but I tried to not stop unless I had three things to do. And this is something a friend of ours, Theo, told Mel that his coach told him to do. And it's something that I've tried to do at most ultras. And I find it's like a really good way to just like minimize faff, which I think is really like the killer for me. So it's just like, okay, like this, my chain's making a little bit of noise. Could I stop and lube it now? Like I could, but I could keep going and like wait until I have to also pee, wait until I need to reapply sunscreen. And then it's like, okay, boom, that's three things. Stop and kind of do all three while you're stopped and then keep going. The only exception to that is resupply, because like if it's 100K to the next resupply, you kind of have to stop for resupply no matter what. I like kind of didn't limit my stop time. I just tried to limit my stops to just essentials. And resupplies are kind of, I think, where my time would go out a bit each day, especially as the race progressed. Like I think early on, I was pretty disciplined about getting in, getting what I needed, eating something, and then hitting the road again. I was normally coming in after people were already there and then leaving before them. So I felt I was doing a good job. And then as the race progressed and you get more fatigued, I definitely started to spend more time sitting on curbs outside gas stations or sitting inside a Subway, just kind of like eating slower and kind of like sitting there for a little bit afterwards, just being like, oh, I'm a little bit messed up. I feel a little ill after eating so many calories in one go, and like things dragged on a bit, but I think that's kind of natural. And I definitely noticed like the people around me, like it was happening to them.
Everyone's starting to do the same thing at that point.
Yeah.
And then I guess the other part of like stopping and keeping to an efficient schedule was sleep. Did you say your sleep strategy?
No, not yet. So my plan was to sleep 4.5 hours every night on average, and kind of like if I had to sleep less, like I was sleeping in an ideal place where it wasn't going to be very restful, sleep less. And then if I was sleeping inside or somewhere where it's more comfortable, maybe try and sleep more. But I'd say I kept to 4.5 hours pretty consistently the whole way. I can think of one night where I slept 3 hours because I got in somewhere late and I wanted to get going the next day. And then the next night I ended up in a motel, so I slept 6 hours to kind of compensate. So I think overall I averaged out to about 4.5 hours, pretty bang on of sleep a night. And that seemed to be a nice amount for me for a race this long. Like I was kind of waking up, especially again in the first half, every day I'd wake up and I felt fresh and ready to go. And I was like, 4.5 was enough. Like I'm ready. Deeper into the race, I was like, oh, I could use some more sleep. But again, that's only natural as it goes on.
Yeah, as it goes on and on and on, you're just like, oh, it's another 15, 20 more alarms.
Yeah, I tried to avoid adding more alarms and snoozing and just being like, okay, get up, start eating. There's one morning though where I like got up, I ate my breakfast, which was a bar, and then fell back asleep for like half an hour, maybe longer, and then woke up again and be like, oh crap, I meant to get going.
Yeah, well, it's 16 days is such a long time to hold it all together. And each day feels like a whole lifetime in like how much landscape you cover, how many emotions you go through. Okay, let's go through Canada. mm-hmm. which is technically two provinces, but Canada, let's kind of breeze through the start and what that was like all the way to the border.
Yeah. I mean, day one, I think I kind of got caught up in the racing and kind of went
a bit. Which he said he wouldn't do.
Yeah. No, but I knew I was going to do. I said I wouldn't, but I knew I would. I didn't get caught up in the racing for long, though. Basically, the first stretch, you follow a double track hiking trail that eventually spits you out into the Spray Lakes Road. Through the double track hiking trail, I was like riding around like Swain Tuft, who ended up being up near the front a lot, Joe Nation, like a lot of people who are quite quick. And at one point, Swain looks over and says, "Spicy start, eh?" And when Swain said it was spicy, I was like, oh, this guy's way fitter than me. And he's saying this is like kind of hard. I was like, okay, dial it back. And so from that point on that day, I kind of like eased off a little bit, drifted back, saw some friends, chatted with them, but kind of tried to stay on the gas as long as I could along the headwindy Spray Lakes Road and then up onto the High Rockies Trail over Elk Pass, just kind of staying consistent. Some of the people in wave two who were faster, like Jens van Roost, who finished third, he passed me on Elk Pass and looked so fresh and was super chatty. So it was good to
Jens was second.
He finished second. Yeah, sorry, he finished second. Anyways, he passed me on Elk Pass. He looked great there. And then into Coco Claims, I switched out of my cycling shoes and put on my running shoes that I'd brought and hiked up there with a friend. And then when I got to the top, I started to fade pretty hard, I think, from going out a little too hard. And also, I think, a bit from the sun, honestly. And so I had a quick little 5-minute lie down, basically right at the summit, where I changed out of my running shoes back into my cycling shoes. And then rode most of the descent pretty fast. I was passing people walking and people going slow, but I knew that it was mostly rideable in what was around each corner because I've done it in reverse before. And so, yeah, rode down it pretty confidently and then just kind of cruised down the Bull River Valley to Fernie. And that was like really nice trending downhill ride. Got into Fernie, had McDonald's, slept. Great night. And the next day, just kind of cruised through the border and like felt good the whole day.
It's actually, now that we're talking, like running through that, you never even really remarked about like the wall is before the border.
Oh yeah, the wall. Yeah. The wall's so short. It sucks, but it's short.
Okay, so describe the wall. Like take us there. Give us a visual of what the wall's like.
So really the tough part of the wall is like, in my opinion, before and after it. So you're on relatively fast rolling FSR from Fernie to right around the wall. And then you're on this FSR. And then there's a turn off of it on the GPS that just looks like a super grown in trail. And the first like 100 meters is rideable. And then there's like logs and trees across it and muddy marsh crossings where your like feet are getting wet and gross. And it's like super slow going, but that's all flat. And then you get to the wall, which is just like, I don't know, it's probably 30 meters of elevation gain over, I don't know, 30 meters of distance, and you just kind of go
straight up
with your bike beside you, and then you're at the top. And then it's again more single track with like overgrown trees, bushes everywhere with thorns, and it's just kind of like, it's annoying slow going, but the like wall itself is kind of just like you walk up and push your bike.
Yeah,
but it's pretty manageable. I mean, I guess some people probably have to carry their bike, but with a lighter setup you can kind of just push it beside you and it's not too bad.
Well, there's the wall.
Yeah.
It's funny. You like I remember you totally just glossed over that when I don't even think you told me about it while you're racing.
Yeah, no, it wasn't like a super impactful thing for me. And then afterwards, there's like, you get onto an FSR that's like overgrown with alders. And again, that like, I think sucked more than the
wall. Yeah, the alders
would
piss me off.
Yeah, just like kind of like ducking around them and hitting them with your shoulders and stuff. So yeah, that part was, I mean, I think pretty nice. I think Canada is the most beautiful part.
And cool,
like
Canada.
I'm totally not biased at all being Canadian. I really think like the Canadian Rockies just super cool. The stretch along like Spray Lakes is like, I've ridden up there before and like I really want to ride up there again because it's just so amazing.
Crazy, crazy, crazy rocks. All right. So Canada ticked off the list. That was like your first 2 days. You're into Montana on day two.
Yeah, into Montana, like think I crossed the border at like 1 or 2 p.m. on day two, early afternoon. I was hoping for a resupply like right on the other side of the border because it said there used to be a like bar saloon store thing there, but it was all closed. And so it was another like 16K to, I have no idea the name of the town, Eureka maybe? Anyways.
That sounds about right.
It sounds familiar. Anyways, so rode to that town and there was a Subway inside a gas station right at the entrance to town. So I stopped there. My friend Martin and then my new friend Bobby were both there.
Shout out Bobby. Also, if you speak Flemish, go check out Bobby's Endurance podcast. I'm pretty mad. He had Martin and Jens on it, but it's in Flemish. So
yeah, if you speak Dutch or Flemish, I think it would be super cool to listen to, but we don't. Anyways, they were there. And yeah, that was like one of those cases where they seemed like they'd been there a while and I maybe only left like 3 minutes after them, 5 minutes after them. But yeah, had a quick resupply, got on the road, covered some beautiful passes, camped that night, like 30K up the road from Whitefish. A lot of people rode past me in the night to get into Whitefish and like get hotels. I knew Whitefish would be like an absolute ripoff. So I was like, I'm not going to spend money there. So yeah, next morning rode down.
Is Whitefish where you saw the sign for Joe Nation?
No, that was Butte.
Oh, damn.
That was a couple days away, I think. 2 days away, yeah. So yeah, Whitefish rolled through. Everything was closed when I got there and like, or 24 hours and off route. Columbia Falls, 24-hour grocery store. Kind of awesome, kind of overwhelming when you're like a bit cracked because there's too much stuff. I had to ask a guy there where the orange juice was.
Staring at it?
No, it was in like where orange juice would normally be though. I just didn't have the brain power to like put together where orange juice should be. I was like in a cooler aisle and was like, where's the orange juice? I don't get it. And it's with the other juices near the breakfast stuff. But yeah, that day was pretty decent. Lots of pavement at start, lots of gravel at the end. I ran into my friend Mateo towards the end of the day climbing Columbia Pass, I think it's called. Super nice climb with a really great single track descent. Saw a guy hunting on an e-bike, which is like crazy. Never seen that before.
That's so America coded, I feel.
Yeah, I know. He was like full hunter camo. His e-bike was hunter camo and then he had a big rifle on the back rack of his e-bike.
You should see my face right now. Eyes are bugging out of my head.
I found it funny because we were doing bear calls the whole way down because you're like lots of tight corners, good places for grizzlies to be hanging out. And so whatever he was hunting, we definitely scared off with all our bear calls and bell ringing and whatnot. But that night we stayed in the teepee in Ovando, which is awesome. There's a teepee in the town park there with two cots in it. $5 donation to, I guess, the Ovando park for them to maintain it. And yeah, great little sleep in there. And then hit the road the next morning to Lincoln and then onwards to Basin that night, where I stayed in the community hall.
Okay, tell the Dot Watcher story about arriving at the pub beside the community hall.
Yeah, so I went over Lava Mountain, which is after Helena, which leads into Basin and then on to Butte. I'd gone over with Bobby and Martin, actually, and then I dropped them a little bit on the descent. I rolled into town, and I was pretty tired. I knew that Butte was going to be another, like, three-ish hours, and I knew that I could maybe sleep inside in Basin, so I was like, okay, I'm going to go into town. 9:55, I roll into the pub. Google Maps told me it was closing at 10, so I was like, okay, maybe I'll get food, but I also don't know that they have food for sure. I go in, all the chairs are on top of the tables already. I look at the bartender, I'm like, I'm guessing there's no chance I can get food, right? And she's like, oh no, I can make you a sandwich right now. Like, do you want one? I was like, yes, please. That'd be awesome. And so as she goes to get ready for that, this other woman pulls up outside on a side-by-side, runs into the door and is like, are you Martin, Robert, or Jake? And I was like, Jake? And she's like, welcome to Basin. Like, so good to have you. I was waiting in the bar all night for you, like hoping you'd show up. And then you weren't here, so I had to go home. And then I like had the tracker open at home and saw you rolling into town. And I was like, he's coming. And so drove back down. And so, yeah, it was like just one of those things. It was so awesome. And she, I guess, helps to get the community hall set up for cyclists. And so
After I got my sandwich, she took me over there and showed me all this food she'd bought for cyclists that were going to come in after the pub had closed. So like instant noodles, crackers, canned tuna, cookies. What else was there? Bags of chips.
Did you get her name?
Judy.
Judy.
Yeah. Judy also is a prolific poster in one of the Tour Divide Facebook groups. She tends to take photos of like every rider that comes through the pub or community hall and shares it. She is super great, super nice, true like dot watcher, trail angel legend. And the Basin Community Hall is also a great place to sleep. I was a little worried that like people were going to be coming in all night making noise. Moa Man, one of the New Zealand riders who'd been ahead
of me. What's his actual name?
Oh man, I think
it's Ethan something.
Or Anthony? Something like that.
Evan? Ethan, yeah. Something like that.
Anyways, he was like going through it. Like they had called in a respiratory specialist for him because he was like coughing so badly. And I guess they said it was okay for him to continue on, but he was like coughing up a lung in there. But yeah, I put in headphones, threw some white noise on, covered my eyes with, I don't know if I covered my eyes, I might have just like pressed them into the bench I was sleeping on and had a great sleep. So yeah, that place was awesome. Shout out the Basin Community Hall. They also had instant coffee in their kitchen that was open to cyclists. So I got to have coffee for breakfast the next morning, which was a real treat.
Oh my God, we'll put the video. I screen recorded Mateo's Instagram story that he posted.
Amazing.
Of you in your base layer in the morning with the kettle on in the kitchen, making a cup of coffee, like smack dab in the middle of an ultra race. And I don't know if it was Mateo's snicker or your hair or what it was, but it was so funny.
Yeah. There was something about that video that was like, I almost didn't want to reshare it because I thought I just looked a little too crazy, but then you told me how great it was.
It was fantastic.
Yeah, no, so funny.
All right. Montana is a big, big, big state.
Yeah.
And it's probably took you the most days of all the states, right?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, I was just thinking like the next day was my last full day in Montana, which was my big push from Basin to Lima, which is my second biggest day on the divide. So it's 365K.
Oh.
And I credit my push that day mostly with like, I don't know what it was, but I got a coffee at the gas station in Butte that I stopped at. And it was like some like sugary, crazy sounding coffee. And it said like extra caffeine on the button and stuff. And like, I was just going for the sugariest coffees because I was like,
calories,
bonus calories.
Baby.
Yeah, exactly. All the carbs. And so I had that and I was like supercharged the rest of the
day. Was this the Fleecer Ridge day?
This was the Fleecer Ridge day.
Okay. Watching Jake's dot. I want you to like hear these two experiences. From the outside looking in, he was like, normally the dots crawl. Jake's dot that day was just flying, like overtaking people, person after person after person, not really slowing down. And I was kind of like, oh my God, like, is this just one day? Is he going to sustain this? And I was like, he must just be, I don't even think you really texted much that day. You must have just been having
a
great day. Now I know it's this extra caffeine,
Caffeine thing, yeah. I know. I felt super focused the whole day, just like really locked in. Passed quite a few people out of Butte, just kind of like picking them off on climbs. And like normally when you pass someone, you're with them for a little while and chat with them. But I was kind of just getting past them so quick that there wasn't much chatter. It was kind of just like rolling on. And then, yeah, Fleecer Ridge, I went up really quick, down not quite as quick, but reasonably fast.
You walked it?
I did walk it, yes. I got to it and looked at it and I was like, I could pick lines down this, but why risk so much? I decided to walk it. I mean, even I think if I'd had a dropper in full suspension, I probably still would have opted to walk most of it just because it was like such a short stretch with like relatively high consequences. It's like maybe going to save me 3 minutes in the grand scheme of things to ride it. I knew I could like walk down it very quickly. So I just kind of like scurried down.
Scurry.
Yeah.
That's a good description. I mean, scurry, I kind of think of people on all fours going down there, but.
Yeah. Went down fast. And then from the bottom of Fleecer Ridge, it was like a lot of pavement. to Bannock Road. And then...
And Bannock Road was fast when you got there.
Bannock Road was fast. It wasn't wet, wasn't muddy. So rode that pretty quick. The sun set on me just as I was kind of nearing the top of the climb of Bannock. I guess maybe an hour before the top of like the climb where you get to the sign that says Old Bannock Road. And then descended down to Lima and got into Lima at 3 a.m., I want to say.
Where'd you sleep in Lima?
Well, I went to the motel because I was like, I'd love a motel.
It's this.
Called the after hours line twice, no answer. And so I was like, to get to the place where I saw the number, you had to go into like a little foyer that was almost like a solarium type room. And then I was like, I could sleep here. And then I was like, no, I know there's a post office. So I went to the post office and there was another rider, Yossi, already sleeping in the post office, but it was big enough. There was room for me too. So I like roll in, try to be quiet, not to wake him. But I'm pretty noisy, like eating a bag of chips while I like inflate my mat and do all this other stuff. Eventually I get into my bag, start to sleep, and then his alarm starts going off. And he snoozes it immediately. And I'm like, okay, he's going to be like sleeping the rest of the night. And then a totally different sounding alarm starts going off maybe 2 or 3 minutes later. And I'm like, oh, why isn't he snoozing his alarm? Like, what the hell? And so I like kind of get up and I like stand up to go over and wake him up and be like, dude, your alarm's going off. Or maybe like, I was thinking maybe I shut it off.
Yeah.
And then I realize it's not coming from where he is. It's coming from like the other side of the wall where I am. And so I'm like, oh, this is like some sort of building alarm thing.
Damn.
And Dan, Dirty Dan, the next day said to me, maybe it's to like keep people from sleeping in it. And I kind of think it might be because it was like not a consistent alarm. Because I think if it was consistent, I could have slept through it. But because it was kind of like a non-repetitive pattern of noise, it made it really hard to just tune it out. Because
I mean,
change.
To be clear, you're not supposed to sleep in the post offices,
no.
But they are unlocked. There's no surveillance cameras, and it is an unspoken, well, we've spoken it, so we might have just blown the whistle, but
unspoken, people know.
It's a thing people do on the divide. You can say whether it's good or bad, but whatever.
Yeah. So I was like, I'm worried the police are going to come. I have a foreign passport. I don't want to get caught up and in trouble here. So I pack up pretty quickly, just kind of throw my kit that I had kind of laying out, airing out into my bag. I don't change. I stay in my like sleep long johns and just kind of stuff my sleep stuff into my rear bag and go
back.
Didn't
you have your pillow attached to your backpack?
I did, yeah, because I didn't want to bother reinflating again. So yeah, I went back to the motel because I was like, well, I figure I could sleep in there. So I went in and slept in this little like foyer thing of the motel. I had a great 3 hour sleep because I guess it was 3 a.m. at that point. And then, yeah, I was woken up at 6 a.m. by the motel, not manager, but the guy who sleeps at the motel and kind of handles the front
staff
desk.
Front desk.
I totally forget his name. He was a really lovely guy. He had a big, like, German shepherd that I was like, when he first came around the corner with his dog, I was like, oh no, this guy's going to chew me out for sleeping here. But he instantly offered me coffee, water, something to eat. And I was like, oh, like, yeah, that would be awesome. And he's like, okay, cool. Like, are you doing the race? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, okay, like, yeah, that's awesome. Like, I'll get coffee ready for you and stuff. And yeah, he was like a wonderful guy. I ended up chatting with him for about half an hour while he gave me a cinnamon bun and coffee and water. And yeah, no, awesome guy. And like totally different experience than what I was kind of thinking would be. And then I hit the road relatively early because everyone else that stayed in town also was waiting until 7 a.m. to ride because that's when the store opened. And so I started riding at the same time as all them and kind of, I don't want to say took off, but
is that the day you saw Dirty Dan?
Yeah, rode with Dirty Dan for a bit that day. Rode with Corey Ostertag for a bit that day, who I know from back here. Yeah, it was a great day. Left Montana, crossed into Idaho. Idaho was so short, I feel like it's almost not even worth a mention. It was just kind of
rough. So sad for Idaho.
Shout out all my friends in Idaho. But
Zach
yeah.
Friendly.
Zach Friendly.
He's from
Idaho.
Idaho.
Jacob Hora from Idaho.
All right.
Yeah.
It got a mention.
Yeah, it got a mention. Yeah, no, Idaho got through relatively quick and then into Wyoming. kind of skirted Grand Targhee and into the Tetons in Wyoming, which, yeah, Wyoming was, first bit of it was super beautiful. I got to the lodge at Flag Ranch, got in, Dirty Dan was eating two burgers that he'd ordered hours beforehand when the kitchen closed at like 9 p.m. and I got in at 11 p.m. So my chances of food were zero, unfortunately. And the campground was supposedly full. The lodge was full, but I was like, oh, I bet I can find an empty camp spot. And sure enough, there was one right away. So I camped in their campground, put my food in a bear locker so I'd have a bit of peace of mind. And then
I feel like you learned an important lesson seeing Dirty Dan eat those two burgers.
Yeah.
And maybe that's where like the experience of the divide comes into play.
For sure. But knowing where the places are that you can get food and knowing like, I think part of it for me is I was really hesitant early on to call ahead places because I was like, I don't know for sure that I can get there. Like, I don't know what the next 50K sounds like a reasonable amount on paper, but I don't know what that actually looks like on the ground because things can be so different than like, yeah, this like climb looks very reasonable, but maybe it's actually like the profile's not telling the full story or the surface is crazy bad or whatever. So I was kind of hesitant to, I think, commit to myself that I could get places early on. But as the race progressed, I started to be like, okay, I'm committing to getting to this location and I'm going to like make the push to make it happen.
Where was the first place on the course? Because at this point you're into Wyoming and you're still not really like, I mean, you did big sends. Obviously you were riding really consistently, doing a ton every day, but like you just said, you weren't really, you know, giving yourself these targets and like, I don't want to say not believing in yourself, but like you didn't want to fall short of those things, obviously, or also like give yourself expectations and then be let down. But when was the first time that you were like, all right, this is where I'm going to get to? Either you booked something, you called ahead, or what have you?
I mean, it was back in Montana, but it wasn't because I'd booked something. It was because I'd mentally said I'm going to get to Lima. But maybe because I had a little bit of doubt about getting to Lima, I didn't call the motel in advance to book something. And so I got there and it was too little too late. But I was like, I did get in my head at like probably 5 p.m. that day. I was like, okay, I have to get to Lima because that's where I have to get to, and just kind of like made it happen. And I'm not sure I guess the next time I did that would have been, I'm drawing a blank, Wamsutter in Wyoming.
Yeah, the Basin Day.
Yeah, the Basin Day. Because I got to Atlantic City. It had been crazy windy to get to Atlantic City from Pinedale. People were taking like 10 to 12 hours to cross the basin. I got to Atlantic City at like 1 or 2 p.m. And so I was like, man, like it could be like 2 a.m., 3 a.m. before I get to Wamsutter. Like, do I want to commit to making this crossing? Because there's like nothing really there. Like, or do I just like think I'm going to camp somewhere? And then ultimately decided to like just be like, okay, I'm going to book a motel in Wamsutter. Left a note for them saying I might be in at 3 a.m. I don't know. And then they called me being like, hey, yeah, we're going to put the key in your room and like you can just show up whenever. No worries.
Sweet.
And I ended up getting in at like 11 p.m. because the wind kind of died as the afternoon progressed and it became way more manageable. And I got across the basin in like 9 hours rather than 12, which was a big relief.
Yeah, but you also like, what was the situation where you got knocked over by the wind or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the basin, there was like lots of drama the whole way across because I had kind of underdone it on the water going into the basin. I'd intended to buy like 2 1-liter bottles of water, like 2 bigger bottles, strap them or not strap them, but put them in the side pockets of my backpack so that I could refill my bladder basically at the halfway point. But the store in Atlantic City, there was no one there when I got there. And I called the number, I pressed the buzzer, and there was no reply. And then when I was like half an hour outside of Atlantic City, the lady called me back and was like, sorry, I was just in the bathroom. And I was like, what kind of bathroom visit takes half an hour? But I was like, no, it's all good. But because I didn't have extra water, I was a bit worried. And then I saw on Martin Van Haverbeck's story that there was a well somewhere in the basin in the first little bit. And so I started drinking my water being like, okay, drink a lot. But I blew past wherever this well was because it wasn't as obvious as I thought. And I only had like a rough kilometer or mile number for it. And so I missed that. And then kind of got to the halfway point of the basin, I guess, with like no water left.
basically nursing one bottle to try to get me to Wamsutter. And then I passed this patch of like still cow water, literally surrounded by poop. And I was like, well, I think I'm going to have to like filter and treat this and hope for the best. And I did. I ended up drinking that water. I didn't get sick, which was good. I think having chlorine tabs.
Did it taste bad or just like chlorine?
It just tasted like chlorine. So,
which tastes bad.
Yeah. The water, to be fair, was actually quite clear because it was deepish, but there was like
stuff around it.
Poop around it. There's poop in the water too. Like you could see at the bottom, but it was like one of those things where I would rather have the water than not have it.
Because yeah, the air was just so dry. If you treated it, then should be in theory fine. Yeah.
But the blowing off the bike that you were talking about, there was one section in the basin where you kind of go across this ridge line and it's like kind of not really a road, kind of like a trail almost, but like you could drive a high clearance vehicle on it. And so it's quite loose. And so the wind was so strong and I was like leaning into it so much that like my bike started to slide on the rocks. And I kind of like ended up being pushed over onto the very edge of the ridge and was like, oh my gosh, I'm about to get blown down. And talking to a few people when I got to Wamsutter, they like had the same experience. So I was like, okay, it wasn't just me having bad luck. It was like actually that windy and actually like that kind of sketchy of a spot to take. But I just kind of like walked my bike for a few meters until the wind died and the road turned away from it. And then it was fine.
Nuts. I think the road signs like that Martin and you might have posted about this too. And then looking at the windy, it was like 55 mile an hour gusts.
Yeah, it was
not
crazy.
Faster. Like it was something like 80 or 90 K per hour.
Yeah, it was some of the windiest riding I've ever done, I think.
Were you scared?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, off-road, not so much, except for that one stretch where I like almost got blown down the hill. That was scary. But there is a stretch where you had to ride on the road where that wind warning sign was. And that was kind of scary because there was like big trucks and stuff passing. Yeah. And like just the thought of like, I don't know, this big truck could get blown into you. So I kind of like hammered that stretch to try and get off as fast as possible. That would probably be the scariest stretch.
I was scared. Not going to lie. I was pretty scared, but was really glad when you got out of there and into Wamsutter. And then like after Wamsutter, there's still, I guess, technically a stretch of like what is considered that like basin zone. It's not the great, like it's not the thing that you ride across, but I think people say it's still like geographically still basin.
Yeah. And I think it's still considered the part of the Great Basin. Like Wamsutter, some people say is like the halfway point, but it's definitely like more than halfway across, three quarters when you're in Wamsutter.
And then what's the riding like between there and the next like obvious kind of like checkpoint or oasis for riders, if you will, is Brush Mountain Lodge in Colorado.
Yeah. So, I mean, the basin, like the last little bit of it was a bit more manageable than the first bit. And then you get some crazy steep climbs that are also like very wind impacted. So that part was kind of slow going. But as soon as you cross out of Wyoming and into Colorado, you kind of get onto this really gradual climb up this little like river valley that's like very dry and desolate up on like your left side, but then down on the right into the valley, it's like super green and lush. So it's kind of like this cool juxtaposition of like dry desert and then that's kind of like leftover of the basin and then like, yeah, lush green river valley. And you kind of just slowly work your way up this really nice like 4 or 5% climb to Brush Mountain Lodge, which is, yeah, like you said, it's an oasis. Like it's very nice. At one point, like probably 2 days before, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to stop at Brush Mountain Lodge, but yeah, I think it's a must do stop for the divide. And it was like so worth it getting like a hot plate of food, getting a chocolate milk in me, bag of chips, like all these like little things. It was just so nice. And also, Kirsten. Yeah, just like Kristen's like such a lovely person. And it's like a really cool setup. Like I wish I had gotten there at like 9 p.m.
Yeah.
Rather than 4 p.m. because I would have loved to have like made the justification to myself to spend the night. But
who is like what other riders or friends were there when you got there?
Who was there? So Jesse was there. Bobby was there. He had done laundry and was getting ready to put his clothes back on and get back on the bike after they had been drying.
Martin long gone?
Martin was long gone. Natalie was there. And, oh, was there one other rider? That might have been it. And then there was a few northbound tours that came in while I was going through there. And so it was good to chat with them for a little bit. One of them was actually touring all the way to Vancouver.
Whoa. Did they give you any intel on like what was to come, or did they say anything about it or not really?
Yeah. So, I mean, they kind of like described Colorado in general as being so nice after New Mexico. So that kind of made me excited for Colorado, but also put a little bit of dread in my mind for New Mexico. But yeah, they also didn't ride the exact route we rode. Like they were on like the Great Divide mountain bike route, which is slightly different than the Tour Divide route is. And so we had a more off-road centric route to Steamboat, whereas they had done a stretch of highway riding. And so they didn't have super accurate intel on what the next stretch was going to be like for us. Mm-hmm. And this was the first year that stretch was actually in the race. So it was a new one for, I think, pretty much everyone, but ended up being pretty good, but nice steep climb in the middle of it.
It's funny. You weren't in Colorado for so long. Like in hindsight, it felt much longer than it was. But what made Colorado so tough or like not so enjoyable?
It's funny. I've tried to like pinpoint it in reflection so many times because it's like something a lot of people ask me when asking about the races, like what was the hardest bit? And I think it was just so many factors kind of stacked on top of each other. I think the biggest one was fatigue. At that point, I was 8 days into the race, which is getting close to like the longest I've ever been on the bike and definitely the longest that I've ever been like racing, only sleeping 4.5 hours a night, like pushing every day. So that was, I think, a major one. The other one's altitude. I mean, you kind of, the nice thing with Divide, I think, is you slowly build up in height. Like every state, you're kind of just getting higher and higher average height. So you kind of get some slow acclimation. But I mean, coming from sea level, Colorado, I think we were probably like average altitude was 2,500 meters with peaks of like 3,900 meters. So I think altitude was definitely a factor in it as well. And then maybe also like this maybe goes back to fatigue, but mindset at that point, like knowing that crossing into Colorado, you're a little bit past the halfway point, like just past it, I think is really mentally hard, being like, wow, I've been on my bike for so long and I have just as much to go. And people say these next two states are so hard. And so, yeah, it's like, I think a lot of factors kind of made it tough for me.
Yeah. It's funny, the expectations piece of all of it, of like, I also think the other thing was, and maybe I contributed to this, but I think a lot of people are like, oh, Colorado is like so lush, it's champagne gravel, and there's also a lot of washboard, then there's the altitude, and like maybe you did have champagne gravel, but like fatigue, altitude, all those things, and then like the terrain not being as smooth as you anticipate, it's just like a recipe for hard times. I've got that Charlie Crockett song in my head and he's like, welcome. I'm not going to sing it for you, but yeah.
Dang. Yeah, no, totally. I think like the expectation of like super smooth gravel, which like a lot of the climbs were super smooth, but I think a lot of the stuff in between the climbs was quite rough. Like there's one stretch in particular kind of between Steamboat and Silverton. That's a long, long stretch, or sorry, Breckenridge and Salida. And it's like washboard flat. When you look at the profile and look at the distance, you're like, I can get this done this morning. And then you're out there in this like 60K an hour headwind, like going 15K an hour on the flats and like less than that on the climbs. And it takes the whole day and you're just like, this is the worst thing ever. And there's nothing to look at. It's all just like dry grass and people's like RV homes parked in the middle of fields. Like it was just a super weird stretch that took way longer than I thought it would. And I think that like really was a kick in the teeth mentally.
Yeah. And then you had a kick in the teeth to end Colorado.
Yeah. Indiana Pass was brutal. Like it was really good to start, like super, it's quite a steep climb for the first bit. Like the climb itself, I really enjoyed. I kind of just like powered up it, had a good climb, big thunderstorm for the bottom half. but I was totally fine with that. And then got across the summit, and then it's an annoying pass, like most passes on the divide, where you get to the summit and then you go down a bit and then you start climbing again. And you go down a bit and you start climbing. And it's just kind of like an endless plateau of like climbs and mini descents. And so on that like first mini descent is kind of where I hit the peanut butter mud, and what should have been like 10 minutes to cover 5K ended up being like 2 hours of just off the bike, walking it, trying to get it clear enough that you could ride, and then riding it maybe 100 meters before you got into another stretch of like super thick mud that just made you grind to a stop.
Dot watching, you had Zach and Natalie kind of bopping around you. Did you see them?
Mm-hmm. So Zach was on a single speed with, I think, a lot more tire clearance than my bike had. And I mean, he was still having to walk a bit, but he was able to definitely come by me faster. Natalie had been ahead of us, and I know Zach also passed Natalie because the next day or 2 days later, he told me that she was like so frustrated by it by the time that he had caught her. At one point I could see both of their lights like kind of further ahead, but eventually lost sight of them. And yeah, no, it was just like such a painful stretch.
And then you just laid down on the side of the trail and got going the next day.
Yeah. When I saw it was 12:30, like I think I'd got to the summit at 10:30, and then I was like, 12:30. I was kind of at a like elevation wise at a low point, because from there on it would be like climbing back up. So I was like, you know, this is going to be probably as warm of a place as I could sleep. And there hadn't actually been many places on the side of the road to sleep, because it was kind of like a steep hill on the right side and then a steep hill drop off on the left side. So there was kind of no flat spots until the one I found.
Yeah. Dang. How many times did you actually sleep outside? Like, I know there was
four motels.
Oh, I was so wrong.
No, you're close. One off.
Okay, so what was the sleep setup throughout the whole race?
Four motels, and then teepee in Ovando, community hall in Basin, motel foyer in Lima, and then I think that leaves 8 nights of sleeping outside.
That's
roughly
a lot.
Yeah, but it was like the weather was so good. Aside from like a few thunderstorms that rolled through, like I never got rained on at night once. I think there was only one night where I pulled down the like hood of my bivy because I thought it might rain. Every other night I just had like the bug mesh because I don't like the thought of bugs getting into my bivy. I was like looking up at stars and it was awesome. And all of my sleeps out were pretty restful as well in relatively secluded spots. So it was nice.
Hell yeah. What was the feeling when you crossed into the final state?
Pretty big relief, I would say. Like, not necessarily elation or a ton of excitement, but it just was like, okay, like one more to go, which was like a really... yeah, really good feeling. And then like New Mexico starts off on such a tough note that I think like the relief kind of dissipated relatively quickly. But at the same time, like I think there was also a bit of a renewed focus at that point on making progress and really like checking the state off. And so I was kind of like, yeah, this is hard, but it's like head down. I think looking at a lot of people's Instagrams who were behind me, that stretch I think really like wore on them and really was like a hard start to the state. Whereas for me, I was just kind of like, I just got to get through it. Mm-hmm. It was like kind of like a super painful climb, like right as you cross state lines. That's kind of like a mini Coco almost, where you're hiking up like a riverbed that's not quite as steep and not nearly as long. And then that eventually leads you onto the CDT, which is a hiking trail. The descent to the CDT is amazing mountain bike single track. And then the climb is definitely a bike push, but I actually really enjoyed that section because it was super varied. Like it wasn't just gravel roads. It was like you had to think about what you were doing and where you were putting your bike and when you're hiking, where you're putting your feet. And I saw my first bear of the whole trip in New Mexico, which I thought was kind of funny because I was told there's no bears in New Mexico, but
Robin also saw a black bear in New Mexico.
So I think they're heading south
for whatever reason. But yeah, no. And then New Mexico from there was kind of a blur. Like I was telling you the other day, in hindsight, there's a lot of pavement in New Mexico.
Yeah. Well, your average speed in New Mexico watching was quite high.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, maybe this was just my perception and maybe I had fatigue from, you know, dot watching for so long, but it seemed like there was fewer opportunities for resupply. So you were doing just like bigger stretches at a time at higher speeds. And then perhaps your rests or your resupplies when you did get to them were a little bit longer.
Yeah, no, definitely. Resupply gets super spread out. And so you do kind of have to push between them. Like I think the whole day after Indiana Pass into New Mexico, there was no real resupply. Like there are small towns in that stretch of Colorado, but there's not like a full service gas station. It's all like restaurants that are selling
a sandwich or something.
Yeah,
like
sandwiches
that.
And selling like mini bags of chips and chocolate bars to cyclists, but not like the assortment that you'd expect at a gas station or anything. And so, yeah. And then once you get into New Mexico, it's kind of like, feels like a full day's ride in between towns for the most part. And there's a lot of pavement, but I'd say the off-road sections that there are is generally rougher, harder riding than the other states. And so it's kind of like an interesting balance of like, you get a lot of extra speed from these big stretches of pavement.
But then you slow right down. Did that play with your head at all? Or did you anticipate that the off-road would be slow? Or at that point, you said it was a blur.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think it was kind of a blur. And again, it was like a lot of like when I was on the rough stuff in New Mexico, it was kind of like, this is just what I have to do to get through the state and get to the finish. And like, less focusing on how tough and hard it was. I did crash on like the gravel pass out of ABQE, like right at the summit basically. And like, it had been super, super rough climb where you have to really like pick your line relatively carefully the whole way up. And then like, I kind of zoned out at one point and just tumbled over and was like, in that one moment was like, this is stupid. This pass sucks. And then it was super beautiful at the top. And I was like, this is okay.
Yeah. How many days to go to the finish was it that you did the 26-hour push to, well, and explain the context behind why you did that stupid push?
Yeah. I mean, I think the context, kind of go back. It was spent my first night in New Mexico in a post office. I don't even know. It was like the post office wasn't in a town. It was like in a weird stretch of pavement. I didn't know it was there. I was descending and was planning to sleep on this next gravel climb. And then I saw it and I was like, oh, I'm going to stop there. And so stopped there. I think I slept for, maybe I did 4.5 hours that night. Anyways, got on the bike the next morning at 3 a.m. or whatever. Got to ABQE about 20 minutes after the gas station opened there. Had one of the best resupplies of the whole trip. They had like these insane breakfast burritos there and like great assortment of candy, that fresh baked goods that were awesome as well. Natalie was there, Zach was there, Jesse was there. And so like kind of had the morale boost of seeing other riders that like I kind of thought were a bit in front of me, but like they'd all been waiting for the store to open, whereas I rolled in just after it opened.
Yeah.
And so felt really good. And then talking with Zach, who had done the race before, he was like, yeah, like we're going to get to Cuba like late afternoon. And then it's a big push to Grants. But I think like there's nothing between Cuba and Grants. It's like all pavement, nowhere to sleep. So you kind of have to push to Grants. And so I kind of got that in my head from him saying that. And I was
okay. It's all Zach's fault.
It is all Zach's fault. I think I was also like before that I was thinking like, oh, like Grants is doable for tonight.
Yeah.
Because also, again, I didn't know what this next pass was going to be like. It turns out it was quite slow going. So I thought maybe I'd get to Cuba a bit earlier and therefore get to Grants a bit earlier. But that kind of like really like cemented that like, okay, I was going to push to Grants next pass, and kind of like the gravel after it was slow going. You kind of do this one big push. And then there's just a bunch of like small little climbs after it as you progressively get lower and lower. And then, yeah, I think I got to Cuba at like 5 p.m., like relatively late in the day. Like
basically dinner
time.
Oh
my God. And you still pushed to Grant's from there.
And I still pushed to Grant's from there. And Grant's is 200 and I want to say 200K flat from there, or maybe 230K. So it's like 5 p.m. I'm in Cuba at the McDonald's eating my McDonald's and I book a motel in Grant's, which is 200K away for that night.
Hell yeah.
And I think I left a note on the booking being like, I think I'm going to be in at 3 a.m., but I don't know. I made sure I called them also actually and said like, hey, like, do you have 24-hour reception? And they were like, yeah, we do. So I was like, okay, I know whenever I get in, I'm going to be able to check in. And so, yeah, roll out of Cuba roughly around the same time as Zach and Natalie and Jesse, who is like a little bit up the road from us. And yeah, instantly I was just like, this is a dumb idea. Like, I feel really like bad on the bike right now. I feel really slow. And I think it was one of those things where it was just slow for everyone. Like, it was a headwind on pavement. You get in your head that you're on pavement, so it's going to be fast, but then it's slow.
It's never as fast as you think it is. You're still riding a loaded bike after 3,000 kilometers at that point.
Yeah, no, it was just crazy. And so I was convinced I was going to get caught. And like, I had it in my head, I was going so slow and I was going to get caught. And after the sunset, I could see the lights in the distance. And like, the roads are so long and straight that everything looks so much closer. And so I was like, they're going to catch me any second. And I pulled over for 10 minutes to like put leg warmers on, put arm warmers on, and like layer up a little bit, eat some food, drink a 5-hour energy to like really get fired up and go. And in that like 10 minute stop, the lights did not get any closer. And I was like, okay, maybe I'm not going to get caught. And so, yeah, I started like riding, rolling, feeling good. Had a few hours where I was like really vibing and doing well. And like, you could kind of see some cool rocks in the moonlight. And I was like, this is sick. And then turned a corner and into like an even worse headwind and like slowed right up. And I started contemplating stopping, and I was like still in service. And I checked the tracker and I see there's a bunch of people sleeping like right around where I was. I was like, oh, like, you know, other people are sleeping out here. Like, maybe I should just like stop and sleep out here too. And I was kind of like slowing up and like dying a little bit. And then eventually Zach catches up to me and he's like, we're doing it. We're going to like push all the way. Like, we're almost there. I hadn't really been paying attention to the profile. It turns out we had been like false flat uphill for the last while when he caught me. And literally like after riding with him for like 10 minutes on this false flat uphill, we start descending. And it was like a false flat descent, but it was like all of a sudden like 15K an hour to like 30K an hour easily. And then, yeah, a similar thing happens where I gap Zach and I think he's right behind me. I start to nod off on this descent. It's like 2:30, 3 a.m. at this point. And I'm like, okay, no, like at this point I'd heard about Jacob crashing from sleeping on his bike. So I was like, I need to like quickly take 10 minutes, just sleep in my kit and then get back on the bike. So I stop for 10 minutes, like set a timer for 10 minutes. I see Zach's light behind me. I'm like, he's going to roll past me. I need to be ready to say, I'm all good and make sure he continues on. And he never passes me. I wake up and his light is like, still looks like it's the same distance behind me. And like, it's such a mind fuck to see that, to be like, okay, I was stopped for 10 minutes and he hasn't gained on me. So I get back on the bike and continue on the next like 2 hours to Grant's. And again, like, you see the lights so far away from when you actually get there and you're just like slowly working through. And I'm like zooming in and out on my Coros being like, okay, I can see the town up there when I zoom all the way out. I'm getting close, then zoom back in. And then 5 minutes later, I'm like, does it look any closer on the map now? Zoom out. And yeah, annoyingly, I'd booked a motel like basically at the very like far end of town, because that's kind of where all of the cheap chain hotels were clustered. And so I get to town and it was still another like, I think Grants is pretty big. I think it was like 7 or 8K from when I got into the town proper to the motel I booked. But the cool thing was that like 7K was all along Route 66. So there's lots of like cool historic signs and like
was
old buildings
sun
and stuff.
Rising at that point?
It was still dark. It was still fully dark. I started to see a bit of glow on the edge of the sky, like right as I was getting into the motel, but it was like I was happy that I got to the motel at 5 a.m. and the sky was still black. But by the time I'd like washed my kit, because it was my first time staying inside in 7 days. And so it was my first time washing my kit in 7 days. So I had to wash my kit, wash myself. By the time that was all done, there was light peeking through the curtains. And I was like, ugh. Yeah.
Are you happy you did that push in hindsight?
Yes, definitely. Hygienically, very happy.
Did you tell the people you didn't shower once in Colorado?
No, I didn't tell the people I didn't shower once in Colorado.
Yeah,
gnarly. I showered in Pinedale, which was my last night in Wyoming, or sorry, in Wamsutter and Pinedale, and then didn't sleep inside once in Colorado. It was one of those things where I was getting to towns that had motels at like 6, 7 p.m. every night.
And too
like,
early.
It's too early. I don't want to be going to bed then and starting before midnight the next day. Like,
nah,
I can't do that. People can, but I can't. So I was just like always passing towns and then sleeping a few hours outside of them. And then it was the same thing the next day. So I kind of got into a bad town rhythm in Colorado and even through New Mexico. And the only way to break that was that one big push. So I'm happy I did that. Even though there was only another like basically night of the race left at that point, it was still worth it to feel clean
it's
and happy.
It's still far though, because it's even so once far. You get to Silver City, which is the last like
town.
Checkpoint yeah. on the map, it's still 200 kilometers, which is like 3/4 or 2/3 of what you were riding in a day.
Yeah.
So it's still like a massive, massive distance. I guess the thing I want to know about New Mexico is when did you start to let yourself actually be like, oh my God, I'm going to do it. And I know you kind of put the afterburners on a little bit in the final stretch, but when did you, did you think about the time at all and your place at all in New Mexico?
I mean, I didn't think I was going to do it until the last stretch of road. So like the last 50K basically, I mean like definitely like you get the belief, but it didn't sink in until like you're on that last stretch. And then, in terms of timing, like that totally like went out the window. In terms of placing, that went out the window until I woke up on the last day. Or not even when I woke up, until I was like 3 or 4 hours into my like last day and I'd passed 4 people who had either been sleeping or like resupplying at some trading post. I'd left Silver City with all the food I would need to get to the finish, plus like as much liquid as I could carry, and then had planned to fill all of my bottles up in Hachita and then get to the finish line with that. So I skipped whatever like trading post thing they were at that was on the side of the highway. And so passed like 2 or 3 people doing that. And all of a sudden I was like back in the top 20. And when I saw I was back in the top 20, I was like, okay, I need to hold them off. So like game on, I get to Hachita, really efficient, like Gatorade, water, get going again. And I'm like, okay, I just got to like keep moving forward. I was even also thinking about like potentially passing the rider that was in front of me. He ended up finishing 2 hours in front of me. So that was like a total.
Was that Yossi?
Pipe dream. That was Yossi. Yeah.
It was more than 2 hours, man, which we'll get there in a second.
Yeah. But I was like thinking like, oh yeah, like I'm on right now. Like we're going. And so I like rip through to the CDT, get onto the CDT, get through most of it relatively quickly. Like it feels slow, but I don't feel like I'm moving slow for the most part. Like I'm not worried about people passing me until right before the end. I get a flat in my rear tire, I think, at first. And so I go to plug it. It's 40 degrees. It turns out Dyna plugs start to melt a bit at 40 degrees and the little metal tip separates from the rubber. And so the tips were starting to like break off before they would go into the tire because the hole was so small. I tried making the hole bigger, all these things. Eventually I got to plug in, inflate the tire, continue riding. I have a small, tiny crash. My rear tire feels low, but I'm like, it's not low enough to bother pumping now. I'll pump it because the pavement's like a K away.
Yeah.
I get to the pavement. I feel both tires. They're both like on the verge of being totally flat. And I'm like, oh God. And so I pump them both up there being like, hopefully the sealant will take care of it. Get on the road. And within a few minutes on the road, they both start feeling super low. And then this is when I start to panic a little bit because I go find the hole in the front tire. And it's the same thing. Tiny hole, not quite big enough for the Dyna plug. I do my best to widen it, but even then the Dyna plugs aren't really going in. When they do go in, I still hear like air hissing and I'm like throwing more air and it's not working. Eventually I'm like, okay, I'm just going to like dump. I brought sealant with me, dump the sealant into the front and rear tires and hope for the best. And so I do that. I pump them up again for like the fourth or fifth time at this point. I check the tracker and like it looks like Mark is not right there, but he is like just about to be off the CDT. And I only got off the CDT like 2K ago. So I'm like, oh God, like I'm blowing it. And like Zach and Natalie are right behind him. Like if this tire problem continues, like I'm going to quickly be out of the top 20.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I like pump my tires up and just start like absolutely hammering on the road, like riding as hard as I physically can after 16 days on the bike and just like pushing. And it's like kind of silly to say that I like rode so hard to hold on to 19th, but also like, I don't know. It feels nice to be able to say like I finished top 20.
Yeah. And also you came so far. I think the other part is like, you don't want to leave any stone unturned.
For sure. Yeah. And so hammered, eventually had to put more air in my tire. I think like 5K from the border, like so close to the end. Like I was like, okay, I'm bouncing like a ton right now. So stopped, threw more air. And at that point I kind of knew that I had it safe, but I was like, he's hammering, I still need to hammer just in case. So I like didn't ease off until like I could physically see the border in front of me and had like 500 meters to go. And then I eased off a little bit and could kind of start to soak it in. And then as I get to the border, all of a sudden Mel appeared and surprised me. And like instantly I was like, what the heck is going on? Like, this is so confusing. You're not supposed to be here.
Did you expect anybody to be there at the finish?
No, I didn't think anyone would be there. I was like, there's maybe a tiny chance Jeffrey's there, but I was like, assuming that Yossi, who was in front of me, was probably already gone. I was assuming like,
oh, Yossi waited with me all afternoon because I was so nervous that I was like, you could have either been on like a really good day or a really bad day. And I didn't know how fast things were going to be. And I was like, I don't want to leave this to chance. And like, I also really didn't want you to see me drive past you on the road. I figured the odds of like you recognizing me in the car. And I did go through the Rolodex of like how I could disguise myself. Like I did have, I had like quite an elaborate plan that like, if you saw me, like how to avoid you seeing me. Anyways, yeah, I got there and I greeted Yossi, and it's a good thing I did because the water, he drank the last bottle of water and da da da. But it was so like just watching your dot refreshing and refreshing and refreshing and refreshing, and just like, and then when you texted me about the air and all those things, and I don't know what I expected when you got to the finish, but I don't think I expected you to be like as out of it as you were. And you were just like, I'm so confused.
I was cooked. I also, I mean, going back to you trying to disguise yourself, I should mention that like my neck was so messed up that I was staring down at my stem the entire stretch on that road. And so even if you did drive by me, I would have no idea, because you were like, there's so many border trucks on this road. And I was like, really? Like, I didn't have any idea what was around me. I was just like looking down.
Yeah.
Head like broken. But yeah, no, I was so cooked when I got to the line, and it like, I think I started to come around reasonably quick, cause I think part of me being cooked was like heat plus going hard for a few hours.
You drank a lot of water, you ate some fruit, you got your,
oh, having fruit at the finish was the best.
Got your shoes off.
Honestly, I wasn't in a rush to get the shoes off.
I was in a rush to get you out of those shoes. I was like, these are probably so gnarly.
But my feet were doing good.
Yeah, Bobby wanted to know, are you happy with the stiff shoes that you took?
Yes, very happy with the stiff shoes. There's so much riding. The hikes, aside from Coco Claims, are all so short that I was super stoked to have something that was a better pedaling shoe. I think I would definitely go back with them. And also I would do the running shoes for Coco Claims again, because it's just worth it to be able to.
Did you just leave them in your hotel room, or?
I left them in the hallway of the hotel.
So not quite a donation bin, but close enough.
Yeah, I didn't see a donation bin on the way into town. I was like, this is probably going to be the best. It was also like at a hostel. So I was like, there's probably
will use them then.
Yeah. There's a chance that someone will use them at a hostel. So hopefully those shoes are being like enjoyed in Fernie now or something.
Obviously it took a while for things to settle in. Like you were just so cute at the finish line. So confused. And it was great to like get to go to the bike ranch and be around all the friends. But when did, I guess, has the magnitude of the ride soaked in yet?
I don't think it fully has. I don't know. Or maybe it like has and it like the magnitude of it is like, I don't know how to answer that really. Cause it's like, on one hand, like, yes, in reflection, I'm like, wow, that was so big. But like, I don't think the accomplishment of doing it has sunk in, if that makes sense. Like, I don't have like this feeling of like, wow, I like did that. It's just kind of like, I did that. Like, it just, I feel very neutral. It was a thing. It was a thing I did. It was a route I rode, a race I rode. And
I think you just don't give yourself enough credit, because it's like, in many years, 16 days was like a time that would win the race. And now it's a time that barely gets you inside the top 20.
Mm-hmm. This was also a very fast year too.
For like sure. But
dry, fast conditions.
But like the record was broken 2 years in a row.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
yeah, the level's definitely increasing in ultra racing very fast.
Yeah. Well, we could talk way more about all the things because it's a crazy long race, but I learned a bunch of things. I'm so proud of you. That was like one of the best. I can't even like talk about dot watching and all of it and getting to go to the finish without crying. I feel like I don't want to cry anymore. So we're just going to put a pin in it there.
Mel's had tears in her eyes for like the last 10 minutes talking about being at the finish. And yeah, so cute. I'm so happy she was there.
It was awesome. I've never maintained a surprise from Jake ever, like tell him his birthday presents, anything. And it was not about like, you know, the success of the surprise, but just to like, I couldn't imagine doing something that big and the people you love or someone you love or somebody you even like remotely care about is there. And like selfishly, I wanted to experience that too. So it was pretty amazing. The dust storm that we had to drive through to get back to Tucson was not awesome, and the highway being closed, but I did. That's a story for another day. I'm just so happy that Jake was willing to share his story of the divide with everybody. And he's, oh my God, Colorado Trail is when?
August 10th, which is like, I don't know, 3 weeks from recording this, basically. I guess this weekend it'll be 3 weeks, which is like, it's creeping up fast. I'm a little like stressed about how soon it is. I don't know where my fitness is really at. I saw someone, Corey, who did the divide, post about finally feeling post-divide
Ostertag?
Fitness. Yeah. He posted that today. So he unfortunately scratched like 4 or 5 days before I finished. So I'm hoping maybe like in 4 or 5 days, I will also have the post-divide fitness and feel really ready for Colorado Trail. But for now, I'm like a little, I don't know.
I wouldn't sweat it too much, but that makes a lot of sense. I guess one final thought to leave people with, like, what is one piece of advice, if you could even distill it down to that, for someone wanting to do the divide or like even a ride that is so big to them that they don't know that they can do it?
I would say, I don't want to say like don't overthink it because that feels a little too surface level, but I want to say like, just take it day by day, as cliche as that sounds. And just like, don't set too much of a daily target or goal and just like ride what the route allows you to ride and like keep it enjoyable and keep it sustainable. Like doing these really big rides, like it's so easy to fall into the trap of like, Justinus does this and Robin does this. So like, I'm going to try to do that and just do what you know you can do. It's a lot easier to rest a lot early on and then cut back than it is to like go in and not rest enough and then try and put yourself back together if you break down eventually. And I think like watching some of the people this year that I eventually finished around, some of them came out swinging and I caught them in Colorado where I said I didn't feel good, or New Mexico where like I also didn't feel good. And so like, yeah, I think trying to rest and ride to what you feel is sustainable rather than trying to like go super deep is the best way to keep it enjoyable and also make sure you can finish.
Yeah, totally. Well, I think that's enough for one day. I'm super happy you shared. I hope people like hearing from Jake. I'm so proud of us for like, we were normal people talking.
This is a normal conversation between us. It was all the beaches from Strathcona Brewing in Vancouver. If I had the address, I'd drop the address right now.
Jake has never been beers. Media trained in his life. Never, ever. Well, aside from setting the level super funky on this one, I'm so sorry, Ben. I'm pretty pleased with how that conversation turned out. Jake and I always manage to swap all these epic stories on the sofa with our morning coffees, and yet every single time we put a microphone in front of our faces, we get so weird. So I'm really happy about this, and also so happy to be able to celebrate all of the amazingness that is Jake. As you heard, I did get to surprise him at Antelope Wells, and I can't even talk about it without bawling my eyes out to play such a small part in that ride, to be able to witness it is so incredibly special, and I am so stinking proud of him. All right, I'll collect myself to do my homework at the end, but if you love this episode, you know what to do. Subscribe wherever you're listening, leave us a 5-star review, and share it with a friend, especially someone who is considering doing the Tour Divide. This could be a great resource for them. I hope you are getting up to your own adventures. Silk Road Mountain Race is right around the corner. I'll be taking off to Kyrgyzstan pretty quickly after this episode drops, actually. A massive thank you to Ben for mixing this episode and dealing with my heinous levels. I'm sorry. I love you. You're the best. Thank you, Ben. And thank you, Albion, for supporting Detours this year. That's all for this week. So until next time, happy trails.
At a little campground. That was a good burp.
Yeah, sorry, Ben, if you caught that one.